Hi, and welcome to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. I'm Evan Axel Bank, and today we're going to speak with Dr. Colin Dickey, the author of Under the Eye of Power, How Fear of Secret Societies Shapes American Democracy. This is his fifth book. He's also a professor at National University and has written for the Los Angeles Times, the New Republic, and the Atlantic. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Dickey.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we start our interview, I do want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. A week before this episode was taped, a hearing was held on Capitol Hill. What does our government know about UFOs, and how much public money is being spent to keep secret whether aliens are here on Earth? One poll says 42% believe that right now there are beings from other planets on our planet. Someone who I know very well says that disclosure will come any day and that the web of people in place to keep it a secret is the most intricate conspiracy of all time. So, Colin, if I may call you Colin, whether we're talking about UFOs, stolen elections, or presidential assassinations, what is it about Americans and conspiracies that just go together?
I mean, it's a really fun, terrifying question. I mean, I think there is a bunch of different ways to answer that. My last book, The Unidentified, really dealt with UFOs along with the lost continent of Atlantis and Bigfoot and other cryptids, and basically why people believe things like that and what they get out of things like that. And one of the things that I kind of came to in that book is that, for example, if you believe in the Loch Ness Monster, you either do or you don't. But if you believe in the Loch Ness Monster, you don't believe necessarily that the Loch Ness Monster's existence is being hidden by the government. Whereas if you believe in UFOs, you almost automatically, you can't believe in UFOs without also believing there's a government cover-up. The two go hand in hand. And so I think that there is something about a kind of expectation for something magical, something mysterious, something wondrous, that for any number of reasons doesn't actually appear before us. We don't have the definitive evidence that we think maybe we should have for UFOs by now. And so in the absence of that definitive evidence, you need to come up with an explanatory mechanism. And that leads you to a kind of, conspiratorial mind frame. Like, I believe there are UFOs. I want to believe there are UFOs. However, we haven't had the big moment where they land on the lawn of the White House and the little guys come out and say, "We come in peace.
Take me to your leader."
Yeah, exactly. And in the absence of that narrative, you have to come up with a secondary narrative, which is, the government is hiding things from us. And so I think a lot of conspiracy theories grow out of that need for that secondary narrative to explain why the primary narrative isn't coming together in the way that you expect it to.
When and how did you come to the realization that we could no longer separate conspiracy theories from the way our government and our democracy works?
Right. I mean, these last couple of books have been a kind of evolution for me and sort of thinking about basically my interest in sort of hidden and invisible things. So before The Unidentified, I did a book on ghosts, and it was a question of it was less a question of, that book is less about do ghosts exist or do they not? Because I think that's a impossible question to answer to anybody's satisfaction. But I think it was interesting to ask the question, what does our belief in ghosts tell us about who we are? And I extended that to, as I said, to, Bigfoot and UFOs. And that sort of led me to this sort of moment where I was like, oh, right, there's a moment in which this belief in the invisible world becomes paranoid and becomes conspiratorial. And that led to my current book, which looks at secret societies from, the Illuminati to Satanists to, QAnon to lizard people from outer space. And again, it's that question of I understand the world to work in a specific way, but yet I do not have the evidence that verifies that the world works in the way that I think it does. And therefore, I need a secondary explanatory mechanism, which is the conspiracy theory.
The first sentence of your book is the United States was born in paranoia. And you describe Cotton Mather saying that there was a plot of the devil against New England. And then you also describe how early Americans believed that the revolution was a plan by the French to draw Brits away from the mother country, Britain, and thus leave Britain defenseless. Have you discovered something about the early settlers, the first Americans, the first generation, something that they had in common that made a belief in conspiracies inevitable?
Right. So, yeah, there, you know, Cotton Mather publishes this book in the wake of the Salem witch trials, trying to sort of kind of make sense of it and also justify his position that witches are real. And the book is called Wonders of the Invisible World. And that is a kind of foundational belief in the Anglo settlers who are colonizing this country. This idea that there is an invisible world and it has real world tangible effects on our lives. And again, Cotton Mather was trying to make sense of the Salem witch trials, which are our kind of fundamental foundational conspiracy theory, this idea that your neighbor, you know, Goody Brown or whoever she is, who seems like an upstanding, good Puritan member of the community, is in fact secretly in league with the devil, spends her nights in the woods doing terrible things. And she's the reason your cow died. She's the reason your crops failed. She's the reason your daughter got sick. You know, these, you know, this idea that the witch exists to explain unforeseen and negative events is core to how the Anglo settlers who colonized this country sort of saw the world. And eventually that became secularized into everything from the Illuminati to the Catholics, to the Jews, to Satanists, to the communists, to any number of things. That sort of has run through American democracy ever since.
Even George Washington, and I was really interested in this, but even George Washington, and, you know, I guess I've heard sort of some of what you cite him as saying before, because I've read a lot of books and I'm, you know, nerdy in that way, but I never quite pinned it on this is a conspiracy theory. But you do. You say that he was subject to being fearful of secret societies, that he warned in his famous farewell address that foreign and subversive forces would employ, and these are his words, many artifices to weaken our unity, often covertly and insidiously. And he even believed that England was controlled not by the king, but by a cabal of ministers hoping to divide the colonies. And this is George Washington we're talking about here. So how do we view his fears through the lens of what is happening today, where Republicans say again and again that so-called globalists control the Democratic Party?
You know, one of the things I found really fascinating about that whole deep dive into that history that becomes kind of the first part of that book, The Unidentified, is the, or not The Unidentified, the new one, Under the Eye of Power, is that when Washington and Jefferson and Adams and those other guys are advancing this theory that the Illuminati are sort of secretly pulling the strings behind the French Revolution, that the, you know, that there are human actors behind these things, it is not, it matches our current definition of a conspiracy theory, but it is not in their minds evidence of paranoia in the way that we would think about it. And I think that's a really interesting evolution. If you think about the way the Enlightenment changed our kind of understanding of how history works, like prior to the Enlightenment, particularly in the West, in Europe, and in you know, North America, the white settlers, it, you know, God was behind everything. If you didn't understand why something was happening, it was God's plan. But the Enlightenment sort of shifts that focus and says, you know, man is the measure of all things. You know, human action, human activity, human agency is in fact the reason why things are the way they are. And so when people like Washington are looking at the French Revolution and they're asking, you know, how did this get so bloody? How did this get so violent? How did this go so wrong? It is not necessarily in their like context, in their time, paranoid for them to say there is a secret group called the Illuminati who is behind everything. That's just a sort of Enlightenment understanding that if something happens, it's a result of human activity. And It's only in the 20th century when we start to understand history as more complex as a result of forces way beyond our control, that people who cling to the idea that there's a human hand behind all these things, a group secretly responsible behind everything, that starts to look like, you know, paranoia. And so, you know, thus the phrase conspiracy theory doesn't even actually get coined until the 1940s. So there's both a through line from, you know, Washington to our current moment, but there's also the sense in which they were thinking in a context that was so different from ours that I think it's important to sort of recognize that, like, this was a foundational way of how Americans sort of understood the world. And in time, our understanding of history changed, but that way of thinking persisted and it became more paranoid and conspiratorial in a way that it wasn't necessarily for people like Washington.
Who are the early American? And by the way, George Washington did warn against paranoia, and many of the founding fathers warned against the belief in, you know, kind of that people weren't in control of their own destiny. Who were the early Americans, and how did they warn others about the dangers of conspiracy theories?
Right. And again, you know, you have to think about, like, they're trying this new thing. They're trying this thing called democracy. Nobody's ever seen this before, right? We're going to do this thing where instead of there being a sovereign power, instead of there being a king, we're going to leave it up to the people. I mean, and for their minds, a very specific group of people, but
yeah.
And then you're going to
careful how you say the people. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like a specific set of the people, but you're going to go, if you're one of these people, you're going to go into the ballot box, you're going to cast a secret vote. The votes are going to be tallied up and then you're going to get results. Right. And that is, that's a totally different way of thinking about power. And they're working on it. They're sort of developing it as it's happening. And so from the very beginning of democracy, you have this idea which persists today and has become really acute in the last couple of years. But it is that if I go into the ballot box voting for my candidate doesn't win. Maybe it's because my candidate wasn't popular enough. These ideas weren't good. We didn't do enough outreach, et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe there was a secret conspiracy. And in fact, my candidate was great. And instead, the election was stolen from us. And so that kind of conspiratorial mind frame, you know, one of the things I write about in the book is that, like, that is sort of baked into how democracy works. That's baked into the idea of a secret ballot. That's baked into the idea of how we kind of articulate our preferences for power. And what I detail in the book is sort of the ways in which over and over again throughout the last 250 years, we have turned to conspiracy theories as a way, and, you know, again, the we is very specific there. Americans have turned to conspiracy theories as a very specific way of dealing with the anxiety that surrounds what it means to participate in electoral democracy.
Where is the scholarship on why people believe in things that they really only have circumstantial evidence for? So I guess I'm just asking, what does the body of work around conspiracy theories look like right now? And has it been effective and digestible for people to be able to take, kind of put it into themselves and then react to it to make their democracy a better place?
I mean, my understanding of the scholarship and what, you know, again, what I've talked about in the book and the sort of other articles I've written about this is that people believe in conspiracy theories not because they're stupid and not because they're uninformed. People believe in conspiracy theories because they give them a narrative that is satisfying, is affirming, is pleasurable to them in some way, shape, or form. And so, like, you know, a pretty vile but obvious example of this is the conspiracy theory that appeared during the Civil Rights era, where white people in the South argued that behind the civil rights movement was in fact a secret cabal of Jews. So it's sort of both anti-Semitic and anti-Black. It's sort of racism on both fronts. But it was a way of articulate for white people to articulate to themselves that Black people in the South did not want their equality. They did not want their liberation. They did not want their freedom. They were happy in as second-class citizens. And it was only because of these agitating, you know, quote unquote, agitating communist Bolshevik Jews who were stirring up trouble. That was what was behind the civil rights movement. So it was a way, you know, it was a way for racist white people to convince themselves that there was not a problem here. And so conspiracy theories often take that form where they offer a way for the believer to interpret contemporary events and the news of the day in such a way that doesn't trouble their core ideas and their core beliefs.
I'm really curious, what were your sources for this? If I interview somebody about a book on George Washington or on Abraham Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt, as I did last week, one of the main sources is this person's papers. And then they can go to maybe a tangential character's papers and go look through those papers. And now you've got two big sets of papers they can draw on, let's say, three quarters of the book. And then they go and run to, you know, the major newspapers of the day and they pull things from there. And that's pretty much how a book is formed. And they might find a new scrap of stuff here or there. What did you look through? I would imagine there's not just like a bank of papers on conspiracy theories because it's so broad. So how were you able to narrow down what your source material would be and how you would kind of put together this body of research to make a book?
I mean, sure. Yeah, you kind of have to cobble from a different bunch of different places. So, I mean, I relied on a lot of people's papers. I relied on letters. I relied on documents. I relied on newspapers. I interviewed people like a friend of mine put me in touch with somebody who was a real 9/11 truther that I interviewed for the book, and he's in the book and really just talked to him. Ostensibly, I had actually called him to talk to him about something else. I forget exactly what, but it was for the book. He knew I was researching this book. And then within a couple of minutes, he had started talking about 9/11 and the Bush administration. And I just kind of let him go. And I just kind of asked him more, and he knew he was being recorded. And he knew he was being interviewed. So I there was nothing untoward about it, but, you know, and I knew various people. I have a friend who I interview in the book who, his ex-wife, who was someone I knew years ago, had become a fervent member of QAnon, much to my friend's dismay. And I we sat down and we talked about kind of what it was like for him co-parenting with somebody who had sort of embraced a paranoid fringe movement. And so I think that my method, I have a PhD from USC. I'm sort of a classically trained researcher, and I use those tools as well. But because these things are often sort of fringe, you have to kind of cast a wide net. And so I just kind of look around for anything. You know, I spend a lot of time in places where, the events that I write about have taken place. So I, went to Charleston to investigate the story of the Denmark Vesey uprising, which is in the book. And I went to Boston to find the remnants of the convent that a bunch of anti-Catholic conspiracy theorists burned to the ground in 1834. And you just kind of go around and talk to people and see what happens. And you kind of cobble together something that way. Mm-hmm.
I want to get into a couple of the specific conspiracy theories. One that I'm really interested in is the slave power conspiracy theory. What was the slave power conspiracy theory and how did it impact the democracy of the day of the 30s, 40s, and 50s?
Right. So in the beginning of the Republic and for most of the first, 180 years of America, conspiracy theories tend to focus on the idea that there is an external force who is, foreign power that is trying to undermine this great project of American democracy and sort of destroy the government, whether it's the Illuminati or the Pope or whomever. The one exception in the 19th century, the major exception in the 19th century is this idea of the slave power conspiracy theory, what Abraham Lincoln and other people called the slaveocracy. And it was this idea that the American government had been corrupted from within by powerful slaveholding interests in the South, that these white men in the South, these slave owners who had money and power, were not just tipping the scales in their favor, but they had actually corrupted and seized government from the inside. And again, that is, that now seems pretty pro forma to us, because since the, particularly since World War II, we have become very comfortable with the idea of conspiracy theories that involve our government being the source of the problem and our government being corrupted by internal forces, whether they're, you know, military industrial complex or, you know, the intelligence agencies or the deep state or whatever. But that was singularly different in the 1850s when the slaveocracy and the slave power conspiracy theory was being alleged. And what it did for the Republican Party of Lincoln and Salmon P. Chase and other people was that it allowed them to gain the support of Northern whites who otherwise might not care about enslaved Black people, Black Americans in the South. These are people who are not abolitionists, who don't care much about, you know, slavery one way or the other, don't have a moral feeling about it, but you could convince them. And what Lincoln and others successfully did was convince them that they were at a disadvantage in their lives as farmers or whatever, because the slaveocracy had so corrupted government that the scales were tipped in their favor, and that the like working Joe, the white working Joe of the North, couldn't get ahead. And so the slave power narrative was, you know, by modern standards, a pretty straightforward conspiracy theory, one rooted in some amount of truth. I mean, obviously these people did have money and they did have power, but it was used rhetorically to create a kind of support in the North against these Southern economic interests in a way that wouldn't otherwise have been possible.
And I was going to ask, you mentioned that kind of kernel of truth. How much of a kernel of truth did you discover conspiracy theories need to have? And I'll just give you an example. It need to have in order to be accepted by, you know, a large enough group of people to be where it's considered a conspiracy theory. The kernel of truth around flat earth might be that when I walk down the street, I don't feel myself going around the curve of the earth. It feels flat to me. So that's enough to make some people start to believe in this idea. Maybe the whole earth is flat. How much of a kernel of truth does there need to be in order for something to take off?
You know, it really depends. Yeah, there's often a kernel of truth that I think that most conspiracy theories, like if you think about it, like take Watergate, which is not a conspiracy theory. That's a legitimate, right, yeah, that actually, you know, like, yeah, like that's a pretty sort of standard benchmark to sort of think about these things. Like there's a break-in in the Democratic Committee. It just looks like a bunch of bumbling weirdos. Like, I don't know. It's just a normal theft. No big deal. And then there's some irregularities, right? You know, they've got weird amounts of money. They don't fit the normal profile. So you start asking questions. You're like, what is this? You know, and, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, and then also reporters of the New York Times sort of start asking questions. And if it's a legitimate conspiracy, those questions tend to lead to other, they tend to turn up evidence and they tend to lead to other things. So suddenly you find, you know, connections to the Nixon administration, and gradually the whole thing falls apart. So I think like most conspiracy theories start from a place of a genuine question or a genuine concern. I mean, the flat earth example you mentioned is an extreme one, but you know, for the most part, it's like, I don't know, you know, like, you know, whatever, are the kids safe? You know, are kids in trouble? That's a totally normal thing to ask. That's a good quality concerning question. You are a person who cares about the well-being of kids. There's nothing weird or paranoid about that. What happens with a conspiracy theory is you don't find the evidence that you would expect if there is an actual conspiracy. And I think that was the benchmark that I really ran through, is that you know, the evidence doesn't play out. And when the evidence doesn't play out, that's when you allege the cover-up. And the cover-up becomes more and more elaborate the less evidence there is. And so I think that most conspiracy theories have some kernel of truth, but they allege something so significant and so expansive that there's no way that such a thing could be possible and yet leave no visible trail. And that sort of leads to the conspiracy theories.
So how much of an an impact do actual conspiracies? So if we're in the 1800s now, you know, let's say the simultaneous attacks on Abraham Lincoln and James Seward have on our apparently inborn proclivity to believe that if there is one conspiracy, there must be many conspiracies.
Sure. I mean, yeah, like this, again, this happens all the time. And like, there are actual conspiracies. They impact conspiracy theories in different ways. And it's because, again, conspiracy theories are doing something very specific for believers. They're satisfying a certain amount of like emotional existential criteria for them that is actually divorced from the actual reality. And I think like the best contemporary example is that when you talk to conspiracy theorists who believe in QAnon or Pizzagate or any of these narratives about a secret cabal of child sex traffickers, you know, child abuse sex traffickers, like that's, you know, that's Pizzagate, that's QAnon. And they will tell you this thing is happening and, you know, these kids are being abducted and they're obviously, you know, legitimately concerned about the well-being of these kids. And then you talk to them and you say, you know, what about the Catholic Church? Like, this is a legitimate, you know, example of a conspiracy. You know, not only were hundreds of people, children, sexually abused, there was a conspiracy to cover that up. Priests were moved around. Priests were reshuffled. Settlements were paid under the table. You know, there's a very legitimate conspiracy that has happened in the Catholic Church that has been well documented. And by and large, Pizzagate, QAnon people that I talk to don't want to talk about that. That doesn't interest them. That is not where their mind is. And part of the reason is because there's nothing for them to do. That story has been unveiled by reporters and in some cases DAs and prosecutors. It is not a story where, you know, the average Joe can log on to Reddit and uncover the truth. And so they don't have a place for themselves in the narrative, so they don't care about it. They fixate on these stories like Pizzagate and QAnon because they feel like they can be part of the action. They can be sort of heroic in their own way. So that's what I'm saying. Like, the truth doesn't matter nearly as much as what the thing is doing for the believer. And what the thing is doing for the believer is both what drives them, and also if you want to debunk them, if you want to like deprogram them, that's where you have to start, not with the facts.
How did conspiracies change throughout the late 1800s? The media changed tremendously during that time, certainly at the risk of making a generalization, but the media went from, you know, you can look in the papers in the 1870s and 80s and 90s and you see stories about Bigfoot, and then this kind of progressive muckraking sort of took over at least the mainstream media at the time. How did conspiracies, you know, evolve as America turned towards the 20th century?
I mean, in a number of different ways, that's sort of a big question to ask.
Sorry.
But like, no, it's okay. It's fine. But, you know, like, I think that post-war America, I mean, this is also true pre-Civil War America, but like, America goes through these phases where we get a strong influx in immigrants of various parts of either Europe or South America or the Middle East or whatever. And it's always very painful for, you know, America to assimilate a new generation of immigrants. And whenever there's an influx, it tends to provoke these conspiracy theories. And so in the like the last couple of decades of the 19th century, a lot of the conspiracy theories were focused around immigrants and sort of the changing demographics of the United States. And that took different forms. So in some cases, it was a paranoia around socialists and anarchists, which were sort of tied up with, you know, Eastern European immigrants and the labor movement. In some cases, it took the form of anti-Semitism, particularly as we get into the 20th century. And so we get these sort of waves of immigration. And of course, it's obviously very much still ongoing with the both the sort of panic around Sharia law with regards to, you know, Muslim Americans and this idea that there's a sort of conspiracy among Muslim Americans to sort of not be good Americans or some crap like that. Or the one that's sort of currently sweeping America and is sort of most violent is this idea of the Great Replacement, this idea that the Democrats are busing in non-white people to offset, you know, voting rolls and change the electorate and crap like that. So, you know, these things happen in waves, and they happen sort of depending on demographic change. And that's one of the central drivers of conspiracy theories, is a way to push back against demographic and cultural changes.
All right. We can't talk about conspiracies without talking about JFK, maybe the biggest conspiracy theory of maybe the most well-known of all time, at least in American history. Do you subscribe to the basic idea that the JFK, and this is not meant to be a leading question, by the way, even if it does come out that way, but do you subscribe to the basic idea that the reason JFK conspiracy theories took off among large groups of the public, despite a very, you know, maybe flawed, but a scientific method to figuring out who shot him and how and potentially why. The basic theory is that people needed something to explain this massive event that went beyond just some random guy with a rifle.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of it. I mean, like, I don't have, honestly, a very strong opinion about the JFK assassination in terms of what I think actually happened, because I think there are moments in American history, or like just history in general, where even the most plausible answer is still like nuts, is still crazy. You know, I think that like everything that I've seen and read leads me to believe it was likely Lee Harvey Oswald, a lone shooter. None of the other evidence I've ever seen seems to be based in anything other than sort of inference and circumstantial evidence. But that being said, the lone shooter Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone narrative is also crazy. Like, I don't like that either, you know? And so like, so my general response is just throw my hands and say, I don't have an opinion on that, but I don't have an opinion specifically on the outcome of that theory. But what I do have an opinion on is the fact that history is often by nature inexplicable. You know, like, it is often hard to understand. It is often like things that are perfectly random, coincidental, arbitrary can have massive implications on how the world works. You know, like, how many, you know, battles were, you know, major military battles were decided by something completely random, you know, the starting to rain when it did or whatever, you know, yeah. Like things, you know, like, you know, the shift in the
World War One, one guy got shot, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, so like, so I believe that history is in part determined on things that are themselves wildly implausible and unlikely and random. And I think that is very difficult for a lot of people to process and make sense of. And so the inclination is to opt for a narrative which maybe is more sinister and malevolent, but at least is coherent in a way that I think is reassuring to people.
2016 is where conspiracies went from bubbling to being the rule. Donald Trump at the center of the conspiracy theories. It all sort of came together in 2016. Why was he uniquely suited to be the carrier of so many conspiracies? And what can that tell us about the future of how we can guard against conspiracy theories taking hold?
The point of the book, the argument that I make in the book, is that Trump is not an anomaly. You know, mm-hmm. that, again, like, you know, Washington believed the Illuminati were responsible for the French Revolution. Lincoln believed that the slaveocracy was running the country. Hillary Clinton had said on record that the government is hiding information about UFOs. The idea that Trump is unique as a presidential candidate or as a president in believing conspiracy theories, I think is not factually correct at all. You know, Nixon was an anti-Semite who believed in a Jewish conspiracy theory. So I think rather, I don't think he is unique. I think that we have a narrative. I mean, I start the book talking about the famous Richard Hofstadter article from 1964, you know, about American paranoia. And Hofstadter's idea is that we've always had this fringe paranoid conspiratorial movement, and every so often it bubbles up into the mainstream, but that there is a sensible middle that can keep that in check. And I think what I found through the research into the book is that I don't think there's a sensible middle. I think we are all very prone to conspiratorial thinking. And I think that Donald Trump is an extreme version of something baked into how American democracy functions.
What about COVID? Because COVID literally tested whether conspiracy theories could be more powerful than someone's own desire to keep living. Vaccines, masks, many people believe that these were things that were quite literally part of either a political plan or some kind of globalist plan. You know, what did we learn about human nature when it comes to exploring how COVID in America wound up the way it did?
Well, right. Again, I mean, like, I think that a conspiracy theory, someone believes in a conspiracy theory, not because they're stupid or misinformed or they don't understand how facts work. People believe in conspiracy theories because they do something for them. There's a the anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss has this phrase about animals when he's talking about animal fetishes and icons of animals. He says animals are good to think with. And the sociologist and folklorist Patricia Turner, when talking about urban legends in Black America, she borrows this and she says, you know, urban legends are good to think with. And I in turn sort of borrowing it from her when I say that conspiracy theories are good to think with. They are pleasurable to think about. If you are, you know, again, if you are a racist person, but you know that it is impolite and unacceptable to express a racist view in public, but then somebody comes along with a conspiracy theory about, you know, quote unquote, the Jews or, you know, Black Americans or whoever, that conspiracy theory can feel very good to you because it allows you to sort of indulge in that. Or if you're someone who sort of habitually just has a difficulty understanding the world in terms of chaos and randomness and order, a conspiracy theory that posits that everything you see is the work of the Illuminati pulling the strings behind scenes, that can also be very good to think with. And so I think that people go to conspiracy theories because they are pleasurable, even if
they could die.
Yeah. And so and I think that existential gravity is really a strong pull for people. And yeah, like it, even in the sense of I'm committed to the idea that vaccines themselves are dangerous. I'm not going to get vaccinated. I'm going to use ivermectin. I got sick. I died. But still, the world, you know, makes sense to that person, or maybe, you know, maybe at the end they change their mind. But that's what draws them. I mean, why do people go to war knowing that they're going to die? They go to war because they believe in the cause. They believe in the idea of country or God or whatever drives them to, like, you know, put their life on the line. How is somebody who's so fervently believing, you know, say that vaccines are fatal, that they're willing to risk their own life? That's the same impulse, right?
How do we train ourselves to recognize a potentially dangerous conspiracy theory and respond to people in our daily lives who believe in these theories before they feed a potentially dangerous beast? I guess, in other words, how do we engage with people who believe in things that are without base?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I've always tried to do, and I've talked to a lot of conspiracy theorists, I've tried to sort of figure out the best way to understand a way in. And what I've found for me works the best is to, again, as I've been saying, start from a premise that the problem isn't that these people are misinformed. So I can't just come at them with, like, the facts and hit them with the facts. That is actually not going to do what I want. So instead, when I listen to them, what I'm listening for is, what is this doing for them? What is it? How is this a pleasurable thing for them to think about? Like, what is this allowing them to do? And I think, you know, a conspiracy theory that's running through a lot of America right now, and again, it's a pretty dangerous one, involves this idea of a sort of secret child abuse, sex trafficking ring run by Democrats and Hollywood celebrities and whatnot. And I, you know, when I see that, one of the things I sort of ask myself is, like, you know, is this person genuinely interested in the well-being of kids? And if so, is there a way that I can tap into that desire to be a protector and defender of children, which is a perfectly good and noble and moral position to have? Can I highlight that part of them, the good part of them, the part of them that I think is valid, in such a way that I can give them something else to focus on that allows them to feel that they are a good defender and protector of children that doesn't require the conspiracy theory that follows? And that's not always the case. You know, sometimes the conspiracy theory is enabling a deep-seated racism or xenophobia or jingoism, and that's a different conversation.
Tell them to go work in a nursery school, right? They'll get over that conspiracy theory in about 5 seconds.
Or they won't, you know, but you can start with like, well, why won't you work in a nursery school? You know, like
to actually protect children.
Yeah.
All right. Do you personally, does Colin Dickey find himself saying, you know, I kind of believe in that conspiracy theory?
I believe in various conspiracy theories, but mostly they're sort of ridiculous nonsense. I believe, nothing comes to mind, but yeah, right. What I will say is, whenever I see something on social media, an article comes across my way, and I find myself saying, this makes sense to me. This makes intrinsic sense to me. Whatever argument is being put forth. That's when I stop and I say, okay. Understand that you're cottoning to this. There might be an issue here. And that's what, and I've trained myself. And I think this is a good thing because I think we all have confirmation bias. I think if you come across something that you're just like, that makes sense to me, you should be wary of the source. You should actually investigate, like, what is the data here? What is the evidence for this thing being alleged here? Because if you find yourself sort of immediately agreeing with the thing, it's a signal that you're probably going to lower your criteria for evidence, and the thing you're agreeing with may or may not actually have any validity.
I am in a never-ending debate or discussion, however you want to put it, over with two people, or a few people, more than two, who totally believe in UFOs and totally believe in Bigfoot. I don't want to have you say yes or no to either of them, but what I want to ask is, when do those things first start appearing in American culture, and where do these ideas come from?
I mean, different. So Bigfoot, there have always been stories of, what sort of anthropologists and folklorists call the wild man, you know, the sort of semi uncivilized, like the missing link. And so you can find stories in various cultures. You can find sort of, you know, news reports from the 19th century. You can find folkloric versions in various cultures. Including European cultures. When Bigfoot sort of takes off is in the post-World War II era, the 1950s, largely because, you know, as I discuss in my book, like The Unidentified, largely because you have a whole generation of men who fought in World War II. They were heroic. They were active. They were physical. They came back, and after being welcomed as heroes, they were sort of put into desk jobs. They were told to, like, you know, get a, you know, white collar job, sit behind a desk. And so these narratives of this sort of wild, untamed version of humans, and specifically a sort of masculine figure that was just over the ridge in this redwood forest, that became incredibly appealing to people. So that's where Bigfoot comes from, you know, and sort of why Bigfoot takes off the way it does. With UFOs, it is a little bit more complicated because they go through a bunch of different evolutions. But again, they arise in the post-war period because we are newly militarizing the skies. You know, we are sort of professionalizing the role of the Air Force, and we're watching the skies in a new kind of way, and we're finding things, and we don't exactly know what they are, and most of them are pretty explainable. I mean, a lot of the sort of major UFO flaps can be pretty thoroughly attributed to you know, weather balloons or the planet Venus or something like that. But it this new focus on the edge of known humanity suddenly becomes a place that's very fraught. So
have you decided what you might do next? Is there a topic? I mean, you write these big sort of sweeping books that really explain major topics, and it's really cool. Have you decided what you might want to look at next for either a book or a major article or piece?
No idea. No. I'm in Chicago right now writing a piece about polka. So, you know,
that was my first guess.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see what the next book turns out to be.
How do you operate? How does your mind work? Do you just start absorbing news for the day and say, oh, that looks interesting, maybe I'll write a piece on that? Or do you spend more time thinking about and cultivating?
Yeah, it's real scattershot. Yeah, it's hard to say. It's just sort of everywhere. So yeah.
All right. Dr. Colin Dickey, the author of Under the Eye of Power, How Fear of Secret Society Shapes American Democracy. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun.
Definitely. Check out the book and also his website, colindickey.com. He's on Twitter at Colin Dickey. I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. And thank you for listening to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Axel Bank History. We update those with clips from the show, guest announcements, and book recommendations. See you next time. Thanks.